You are listening to Max Chem Through Pod, the podcast organized by the Max Chem Center for the Study of Ethics, the Economy, and Social Change at the University of Cambridge. This time, Center Coordinator Johannes Lenhard met Professor Tanya Lerman at Stanford to talk about her lesser-known work on homeless people struggling with mental health and drug addiction.
Good. So people know much less about your work with people on the street, often people that have mental health issues, schizophrenia, drug addiction issues, than about what you've written on religion and belief. And perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about how you got to work with that particular group, what the circumstances were, and whether it's still something that you follow and that is ongoing.
So I began doing this work at the end of a project on psychiatry. So I was trying to understand psychiatric residents and these two cultures I thought they lived in, the more psychodynamic and the more biomedical, and how those worlds were different. And it sort of occurred to me that it would be helpful to get to know a little bit about the patients they worked with. And I was sort of interested in psychosis. And so I found somebody in particular to hang out with in San Diego, who was a very interesting guy who'd spent a bunch of time in the street. And he had then gotten housed, and then in the course of my knowing him, he became unhoused and ended up homeless again. And so I was thinking about all of that when I arrived at the University of Chicago, and a member of my department said, "Oh, you should go to Uptown." So Uptown is this amazing area in Chicago that has the highest per capita rate of psychosis than any other place in Illinois apart from the jails. So it's like this three block square area with over 60 different kinds of agencies and many, many people who would meet criteria for some kind of psychotic disorder. And it's been that way for years and years. It was sort of the dumping grounds for the hospitals after deinstitutionalization. So this period in the 60s and 70s and, you know, whatever, in which there was a shift in policy from long-term psychiatric care in hospitals to, you know, care and community centers. And that was never, the shift was never fully funded. But Uptown was this area of Chicago that he had these big old hotels that was once, it was once the last stop on the train to the Loop. And these hotels were built for the performers who were often not white. And it was a little, they were often housed at the edge of the city. And then the big hotels were built, that was way back in the 20s. And then, you know, the entertainment industry went out to Hollywood, and then the hotels became full because it was the last stop in the train. They became full of white collar workers. And then those guys went out to the suburbs just before institutionalization. And so these hotels became full of people released from hospitals. And so when you drive up there, it's an amazing place because there are these beautiful hotels. It's a very, you know, there are lovely sushi bars and lovely gyms. And some of the hotels have been converted into, you know, lovely condos for young professionals, and then, you know, there are a lot of very psychotic people wandering around on the street. And so I thought that was fascinating. There's a silverfish, oh my god. So I thought that was fascinating, and then so decided to hang out, and then I was funded by the NIH to hang out there and to ask a very policy relevant question, which is by the way the only way you get funding from the NIH, and which was like, why don't people want help? And of course lots of people do, but it's really striking that many people who end up on the streets resist the kinds of offers of help that you can get through different kinds of funded agencies. And so that was my job, to figure out why, when that help was offered, people would say no, because I knew they wanted housing, but they wouldn't take this housing. Mm.
That's the argument that you make in one of your papers, that putting exactly this question at the core of it, why do people that are offered housing not take it? And you're giving this interesting answer has to do with housing that comes with mental health diagnosis, comes with stigma, and you can't really have that on the street because then you're weak.
Exactly.
And in order to survive on the street, you have to appear strong.
Exactly.
And that's particularly complicated for women.
Right. And so what I argued was that there was a culture of being on the street, that it wasn't just that people happened not to be housed, but there was a way of living and being and experiencing that was particular to this environment. And one of the features of this culture is that there's a model of what it is to be crazy, that people, have this idea that the street will... I decided there were really three components of this model. There was the idea that the street, being on the street, by which I mean living in this gray underworld of shelters and sleeping in the park and sometimes getting in the house and using soup kitchens and drop-in centers, that people would say that being on the street would drive you crazy. They would say that some people are more vulnerable than others to going crazy, and that when somebody went crazy, it was permanent. They were stuck. And so what I saw is that people didn't want to be crazy. Makes a lot of sense. And they also lived in a world in which one of the things that people said is that you have to be strong to be on the street, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, it actually is pretty tough. And even when you're safe, so there's a lot of ways in which it's not safe to be a woman on the street. And a lot of people had partners who had sort of complicated features as being partners. So women would sometimes get social security money, so they would be supported by the government. This at the time it was like $600 a month. So their partners would, if it was a male partner, sometimes were more interested in the $600, and sometimes would use that for drugs of various kinds. And so it was pretty easy to think that the women were being exploited. But if they didn't have that partner, they'd be exploited by somebody else. And so anyway, so it's tough on the streets, even in the shelter. You're staying in a shelter and there are 80 people in the shelter, and it's all shared bathroom space, and that your bed is 5 feet away from somebody else's bed. And the shelters are often charming and quaint and delightful when you visit them for a couple of hours, because they're sort of like trendy restaurants. They've got cool cement floor and they're truly shabby chic. And but if you're living there, your stuff's not safe and you can't sleep because there's always somebody who's crazy and screaming. And it doesn't feel physically safe, because even though it's technically safe, but somebody's usually got some kind of weapon. And it's pretty frequent that something happens. And so people don't feel safe. And so they've got to be strong and tough. And that means sticking up for yourself. And it often means, being so difficult that nobody wants to take advantage of you. And and that creates its own problems, because the shelter has all these rules and they want you to behave properly, and being proper is not a way that you scare anybody so they're not going to mess with you. So it's just tough. And that's what I saw, was that it was tough to be on the street. People didn't want to be crazy. They didn't want to go into these places where they would be labeled as crazy because they thought that that was the end of their existence. And they thought it was about being weak. Mm. They didn't want to be weak. Mm.
Do you see that there's this, what I just describe in a different environment in Europe, and so often coupled between drugs and shelter. You couldn't be a particularly injecting drug user and be part of or be accepted into a shelter. Mental health was often put to the side, but drug use was kind of a problem in a lot of these contexts.
Yeah.
But the argument or the question that I have holds in both cases, is there a weird link that potentially society imposes that we don't really want to deal with, some cases drug addiction, in other cases mental health, particularly not if we offer you help. Well, so is there a moral problem that...
I think it's a moral but also just a very practical problem. The people who are neither using drugs nor psychiatrically ill, they are not an issue. I mean, they will be, and we know this, this used to be the case. I think it might still be the case. I mean, those people are spending an average of 3 months unhoused, and then they're fined. You know, they're not fine, and these days it's so expensive that more of them are less fine for more time. But they basically figure out how to function. It's this other world that is much harder to figure out how to help and to function. And so and many people are now sympathetic to what you'd call harm reduction. And so you let people come in and use. You just offer them shelter. Or you say, like it used to be the case, that if somebody had a psychiatric issue, there was a deal. We'll give you the housing if you go for care and take medication. And people just didn't want to do that because... in part because they didn't have the insight to know they needed it, but more important, I thought, was the fact that they didn't want to be crazy for very good reasons. And so, I think it's now there are many successful programs that do what we'd call the equivalent of harm reduction. So, you know, housing first, just give people the housing, and it's just cheaper apart from anything else, and it probably keeps people healthier for longer, and it comes with its own problems, but it all comes with its own problems. So I do think that one of the moral issues is that there are a lot of different moral standards from people offering care. So you know, all these agencies that I saw up in Uptown, they all had their own vision. They were not coordinated. Some of them were religious, some of them were not. Some of them, you know, had the strong view that if you were going to be given something, you had to take it on terms. A gift is never free. You've got to, you know. And there are many different kind of moral stances. So, it's, I do think that it's more effective to try to offer as much of a free gift as you can.
What do you think the role of the state is in all of this? You say in one of the papers, the street is the long-term hospital for people with mental health issues because, and you mentioned deinstitutionalization before, there was a decision being made by the administration 40 years ago that there is no such thing in the actual hospital anymore as long-term care.
So this is increasingly a fraught issue in American society, as you know. I think it's more efficient for federally funded shelters to be available for people. I just think that's more efficient. And I think that if it's federally funded, then you have a ghost of a chance of actually kind of organizing other shelters in the neighborhood. And if it's federally funded, it gets messy because the federal funding always has this new cheery idea of how to help. And so they make a plan. And then all the care has to shift to follow the current plan. So the new flavor of the month is recovery. So everybody, you have to have the view that everybody can recover from everything. And so, which means that they can be sick for a shorter period of time, which of course is very financially advantageous to the state, because the state doesn't have to accept them as clients forever. You can decide that somebody de facto, because recovery is a possibility, they can't be eligible for care forever. And so I think it's more humane and more sensible and more effective for the state to provide significant amounts of shelter care. I don't see us getting there I don't see us getting there anytime soon. But we're a little more lucky than we might be, because there is there is money available through Medicare that is targeted for people who are disabled. Mm-hmm. So it's insufficient, but it's not nothing.
Mm. And what do you see your role to be as a researcher who then publishes in journals that, and we are coming to a methods question that's more straight on in a second, that might have an influence on providing evidence to say, look, this is what, and you're making that quite explicit in some of these papers, this is what is happening, and this is where there is some issues with it, and here are some alternatives.
So that's a very good question. I think I decided that there are two ways to have an impact. One is by publishing in scientific journals, the psychiatry journals. And so I've done that. I published my overall observation in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and that was very exciting. And it's hard to do that as an anthropologist, so that was great. And it's hard to get qualitative work into that journal, so that was very exciting. I've published some papers that are more literary and not so much in anthropology journals. And I did that because it's fun to learn how to do that, and there arguably you have a little more impact. And I've published some pieces in anthropology settings, so in collected editions or in, collections of case studies. I never wrote the book, and I should have done. I'm still sort of planning to write the book. And I guess I kind of decided, the reason I didn't do that is because it would be a literary book that showed you how difficult it was to live on the street. And I think there's a really important place for that book. I wasn't sure how much it would add to anthropological theory, and at the time I was also doing this project on religion, where I thought there was a cooler puzzle that more people would be interested in. So I went in that direction. And the other thing is that I found it a little distasteful to, I really think there's a value in writing about the pain that people experience. But it's a little awkward to do what some people would call the pornography of violence. And so there's something really important about that, but it's also a little awkward. And so that's why I didn't do that. Mm-hmm. And, it might have been a better choice for anthropology in its moment to go the route of writing this book on homelessness. But that's not the route that I went.
Perhaps the last question to finish on methods. It seems like you've used a lot of anthropology methods in terms of ethnography, but then you supplemented that with not quite quantitative data, but you send research assistants out and they did follow-up interviews and they did something that was much more comparable. And obviously with new products, you've moved even more in that direction.
Right.
But do you think that's something that anthropology doesn't do enough, particularly if it's about policy-relevant issues?
I think that numbers are really helpful. I think that the ethnography is what makes the argument persuasive, but it's ethnography is vulnerable to the charge that it's just an anecdote. You know, it's just what this one ethnographer saw. And so if you can just make the claim that it's not just you, but other people see it as well. You know, you send a student out to re-interview. Or if you make the claim that, you know, you ask the question in a different way and you get a similar sort of result, then it makes the ethnography more compelling. And, you know, and I know that some people worry that that's sort of selling out, or it's not letting the ethnography speak, but I think it's hard these days, particularly when you're trying to convince people who are in positions of authority to make some practical change. It really helps to have some extra data. And it's not like it's, you know, I mean, it's sometimes hard to add, it takes work, takes money, but you know, it's not that difficult, and it can make a big difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. Thank you for this.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about our center and its research, sign up for our newsletter at maxcam.socanth.cam.ac.uk.